should. Okay, thanks, Jay. Thanks, everyone, for being here this afternoon. I'm going to keep your attention focused on land reclamation in boreal Alberta. So I'm going to present to you forest floor development and reclaimed boreal forest soils of northern Alberta. I think actually my title is sort of different in the abstract, I realize. I'm essentially looking at spatial patterns in reclaimed boreal forest soils. Oops. Okay, so the challenge of land reclamation in any scenario is to... The challenge is to return our ecosystems to an equivalent land capability. And so in the case of boreal Alberta, this means generating or recreating productive forest ecosystems in the upland environments that are going to satisfy wood fiber production in the future. All of the areas that are being surface mined currently for oil sands are being taken out of the local forest leases, annual allowable cut. And so the forest industry is really concerned that these areas are returned to sustainable ecosystems within a manageable time frame or an economic time frame of 30 years or less. And so what we're trying to learn is how to go from these surface mine systems down here. So this is an open pit mining where they salvage materials for land reclamation uses later on from the surface, and they stockpile overburden materials, and then they build these overburden dumps, and they're typically, a lot of the reclaimed sites that we're looking at right now they put capping materials on the overburden dump and then revegetate them, and so that 1 year after capping material we might have a bare surface here, and then 5 to 10 years later we have these aspen or spruce or pine ecosystems that have developed. Is there the sort of characteristic canopy plant species in boreal Alberta? And then the question is, you know, in 30 or 50 to 100 years, are we going to get these sustainable, mature ecosystems, either aspen or jack pine? This is just an example of a jack pine forest. And I think that's it's a really difficult question to answer in terms of what does sustainability mean? I think the best definition of sustainability that we can use is that these ecosystems are resilient to disturbance. But of course, our industrial partners don't necessarily want to disturb these ecosystems after developing them or letting them develop for 30 years. And I come in and say, I want to burn them. They don't really like that very much. So we need to look for other metrics. And part of the problem here then is in the oil sands, every sort of reclamation scenario is unique in that you have to use materials for reclamation that are locally available. We can't transport materials in great distances, especially not at the scale of surface mining in the oil sands, where we're disturbed about 650 square kilometers of land so far, and that's projected to increase to about 1,700 in the next 10 years. So the problem in using sort of locally available reclamation materials in the oil sand is that we're converting these peatlands down here to upland forest soils. So we have a lot of wetland material and organic matter rich materials is peat, and that's being used in a peat mineral mixture. And so all the sites I'm going to talk about today have a capping layer of about 20 centimeters of peat mineral mixture to try to recreate that age horizon dynamics. But you know, we're taking organisms or a microbial community that's adapted to an anaerobic environment and putting it up in an upland aerobic environment. And the other thing that I just wanted to mention is that when they rebuild these sites, they're amazingly homogeneous sites. They have bulldozers with GPS units on the blade that are automatically telling it to like go up and down. They have about a 3 centimeter divergence in the elevation of different treatments. So they're building amazingly homogeneous sites. So to look at sort of some of these, to try to determine, indices of reclamation success or sustainability, we look at these key response variables, including things like plant productivity, nutrient fluxes, as Ty mentioned, nutrient fluxes with resin, ionic resin analysis. We can look at hydrology, deep surface hydrology. There's a lot of hydrogeologists working on these sites looking at, these are saline sodic overburden materials, so there's saline seeps and potential problems with that. And then microbial diversity, and so looking at the organic matter quality is possibly a good way to tie all of these features together in that they're all related to each other. But by looking at all of these sort of processes individually and just making observations or about observations in time, it doesn't. I'm not sure that it's really getting to or helping us to answer this question of sustainability or better yet, are we on a trajectory towards natural ecosystem processes, right? So by making observations, we're not necessarily dealing with the processes or mechanisms at work. We're just looking at reclaimed sites and comparing them to mature target ecosystems, which of course are going to be very different from each other. If you have a 5-year-old forest and a 100-year-old forest. So I'm trying to make the argument that we should be looking at other juvenile disturbed sites like fire or harvesting, and that's sort of coming online now, and so something to look for in the future. But one of the ways to possibly tie together these observations into a process or mechanistic basis to get at this idea of whether or not we're on a trajectory is to look at the role of space and to go back to sort of Tobler's first law of geography, is that everything is related to everything else, but near things are more related to each other than far things, right? And so we can use space sort of efficiently. We can look at all of our different key variables, and we can assume that they're all tied together, or they're all related to each other in space, that everything is related to everything else in an ecosystem by some spatial connection. And what we can do then is we can use spatial statistics or geostatistics to try to model the spatial residual to give us more information about the mechanistic processes by eliminating the variability caused by other spatial autocorrelations or third-party correlations, we'll call them. And to do this, instead of an inductive process, we're using deductive inference to try to look at the big picture and separate the pieces of the puzzle from there. And so, as an example, we can use space as a surrogate for unmeasured variables. And so in this case here, if you're trying to look at the effect of, let's say, soil nitrogen availability, and you want to try to determine if there's an effect, as I'm going to do here today, if there's an effect of distance from tree. So if I have sample A is close to the tree and sample B is far away, and then same thing down here, C and D, C is far away, D is close. Well, if we just looked at these observationally and correlated them, there's going to be sample B for nitrogen availability will be different from C, given that there's a slope feature here, there's a topographical feature, and you might expect organic matter deposition down here, and so you would expect these to be different based on topography. But if I were to go ahead and sort of make measurements based on this XY coordinates and then use the structure of the spatial residuals, I can eliminate the effect of the spatial residuals and call that a surrogate for topography. And of course it could be a surrogate for a lot of other things that I haven't measured as well. But in that case then, it would allow me to look at, to deduce whether or not there was a distance effect sort of in the absence or after accounting for that spatial effect of topography. And so that's what I'm trying to do today. The objectives of this overall study then were to investigate the effect of stand type on forest floor development and microbial community structure over time. That was the first part of a graduate student study. And what I'm going to focus on today is this objective 2, to examine the effect of stand type and season on the spatial pattern of forest floor development and soil nutrient availability. So what we did then is we went out and we sampled spatially explicit samples with XY coordinates in this sort of random walk design, and this was designed to maximize the distance lag classes in order to have greater than 30 observations so that our spatial statistics have good power. And what you can see then, so what we did was we had these 15 macro sites, and then we had 4 sort of micro sites around them that were oriented in cardinal directions that were randomly chosen from 0 to 2 meters away from the macro point. And so that gave us 75 samples per stand type. We looked at aspen, pine, and spruce stand types. So that's 225 spatial samples overall. For each of these spatial samples, we installed these PRS resin probes. So this is, as Ty mentioned, ionic resin analysis. And what this does is it traps nutrient ions in the soil profile in situ. We left them out under different seasons. So we leave them out for sort of this overwinter period, spring period, and then a summer period, so that we can actually get seasonal variability in spatial patterns. And then the graduate student, Preston, also went in here and he used a total station and surveyed every single location of the canopy trees within 10 meters of a sample location. And he further measured the canopy size by taking survey points and cardinal directions of the canopy edges. Okay, so it's a pretty unique data set. We have resin and nutrient availability with resins. We have forest floor mass at all of these sites. And then we have canopy tree distribution and canopy cover variables. One of the things we're missing then obviously are we didn't measure topography and we didn't measure microbial community structure. So those are some potential candidates for that space term. Okay, so we'll get right into the spatial dependence then. The first thing that we did was look at variograms, and so these measure spatial pattern, and they also give you a spatial predictability is associated with this analysis. And so for the case of the data that I'm going to show you today, everything had a spatial predictability of greater than 50%. Okay, so and that's one way of saying that the variogram there's a significant relationship in that variogram at a certain patch size. I'm just going to report to you sort of in this cartoon format patch sizes and the amounts of nutrition or amount of canopy layers in these different stands. So what we can see, the first thing then, is that aspen had a canopy cover of 3 meters. So what that means is that that the patch size for aspen were 3 meters in size, and that within this 3 meter patches, the average amount of layers of trees was 1.3 layers. If we look at the canopy cover in pine, it was different. It had a different spatial pattern there. Now it's 5 meter spatial pattern, so 5 meter patches, with an average patch layers of 2.1. I got 3 minutes? Okay, no problem. So you can see there's some differences there. And what that might do is translate into differences in soil nutrient availability. So what we can see is that fall nitrogen had a similar patch scale as the canopy cover and was autocorrelated within this patch size at about 10.4 micrograms. And if we look at the spring nitrogen and summer nitrogen variability or patch size, we see that it changes out to 5 meters in the springtime and out to 16 meters in the summertime. Okay, and we also see that there's a change in the amount of nitrogen availability going on. And so you might say that this change here could be related to root uptake in the material, but at a patch scale that's much greater than canopy cover. So you could assume that, let's say, roots are distributed in the same area as canopy cover. Maybe that's not related to uptake. Or because these are aspen and they're clonal species, their root structures might be sort of more uniform in the soil surface, and therefore we're just measuring uptake. If we look at soil, if we look at pine nitrogen, we have, in the spring nitrogen is 4 meters, so just less than the canopy cover, so those are probably related. And then summer nitrogen, again, this patch scale increases 10 meters, but it increases, the amount of availability increases. And so what's difficult to resolve with resins analysis, what you have to keep in mind is that when you put resins in the ground in competition with roots, they're not necessarily measuring the overall pool of nitrogen, they're measuring what's in competition. So this is basically what I think we can say here is that these are all built on the same kind of substrate, peat mineral mix, so they all theoretically should have the same amount of nitrogen availability, but aspen seems to be taking up a lot more nitrogen in the summer than pine do. And these sites are 25 years old. So seasonal variability in patch size and available nitrogen, and the spruce had no significant spatial or seasonal variability, so it didn't show here. The next thing we can do is look at spatial ANOVAs, which is a one-way ANOVA where we can basically isolate different components that we measure, canopy cover or forest floor mass, but we can also look at the effect of season and this spatial component or this intercept term. So the very first thing we can look at is nitrogen availability, and these are the parameter estimates, and the asterisk indicates level of significance. And so parameter estimates are, because the data is all normalized to each other, one unit of change in the parameter estimates, so one unit of change in distance is going to lead to 2.29 units of change in nitrogen. And that's increasing away from the tree. So again, this is probably reflective of uptake of nutrients. The canopy had a significant effect on nitrogen, sulfur, and calcium. And the forest floor mass had a significant effect on phosphorus, in this case negative. So more forest floor mass resulted in less phosphorus availability in the substrate, potassium and calcium. Season up here then, season had an effect on both phosphorus and sulfur, and these are negative as well. So with changing season, we have decreases in these availability. And then the intercept term was significant. So the intercept term includes the error as well as the spatial residual term. Space had a significant effect on phosphorus and sulfur in the aspen. If we go to the conifer system, then I just lump these together. We see that distance from tree affected phosphorus, canopy cover only affected potassium, and the forest floor mass affected sulfur and calcium. If we look at season here, now it's having a significant effect on nitrogen and sulfur, and the intercept is also having a significant effect on nitrogen and sulfur. And so there's a strong difference between stand type there, between the aspen affected season and space affected phosphorus and sulfur, whereas in the conifer systems, season and space are affecting nitrogen and sulfur. And so, again, this, I'll come to that in conclusion. So basically, what we can see here is that spatial dependence showed us that there was small-scale variability in some available nutrients. And what I didn't show you, so for example, nitrogen in the conifer stand had a fairly small-scale variability. And forest ecosystems are generally characterized by variability at less than 5 meters, let's say. And agricultural ecosystems are characterized by variability at 30 meters, greater than 30 meters, especially if you have a till system where everything is homogenized every single year. So there was still large-scale variability was still present after 25 years of development in some of the nutrients, like phosphorus in the soil and aspen and some other ones as well. And so what that's sort of suggesting that the reclaimed landscape is very uniform, and so maybe that's hindering development of the forest, of the ecosystem over time. And if we added more heterogeneity into actually rebuilding these systems, maybe there would be more diversity and there would be more like a natural system sooner. So I think we could get this down, this from 25 to 30 years down to less than that. But that remains to be seen. Canopy cover increase, some variables, nitrogen and sulfur in the aspen. Increased potassium in the spruce, and then season and space had large influences too. So the main conclusion then is that canopy closure is essential for organic matter composition, microbial community composition. That was data from the first objective of the study I didn't get to show you guys, and plant nutrient availability. And it seems like, and this is sort of corroborating what Ty was suggesting, that aspen has more canopy and more forest floor influence on available nutrients and therefore better soil veg components. And so it's being promoted as a model plant for reclamation in this ecosystem. And I'll just, I'd like to acknowledge my field assistants and industrial and government partners, and I can take any questions. We do field work in July in Edmonton. No, it's in October. We do field work in the snow sometimes.